Hello, welcome everyone. I am joined today by Rachel Jensen. A little bit about Rachel. She's a licensed massage therapist, a certified health coach through Duke University, certified integral yoga hatha teacher, and is currently pursuing her certification in somatic, experiencing a body-based approach in dealing with trauma. So a lot to talk about here. But actually, I want to start, Rachel. Your Instagram handle caught my attention. Let's do less.
Yes. So many years ago, I'm a bit of a social media phobe in some ways, although I've come to appreciate a lot of aspects of it. But I made a joke many years ago with a friend that if I ever was a presence online, that my handle would be something like Let's Do Less. And I would just pop up occasionally and be like, take a nap. Thank you. See you in 2 months. But I've really become to like embrace it in my practice. There's so much striving and hustling and so much information in society and in culture in our lives right now that I just really like to encourage people to slow down even a little bit. You know, I think there's such a beauty when I come to the ashram and get to leave everything behind, but there's so many practical daily ways that you can do that as well. You can check in. Also, Let's Do Less is a little bit about doing less of things I don't want in my life and bringing in more of the things that bring joy.
Have you found that there's been like personal growth for you in this area? Like you've enhanced your ability to do less or focus more on the things that you actually want to be doing and less on the things that you don't?
I think so. I think absolutely that's the case. I think just giving one permission to pursue the things you're interested in, and also permission to move at a slower pace, which even now in the current, you know, in daily life out here, there can be just a lot of people who are all going. So having that to tap into, like, I don't have to do that. I can stop. I can take rest when I need it. That doing less is really powerful. Doing less is occasionally doing more for yourself, for your nervous system, for healing. Sometimes we get this idea that healing is like more and more and more work. And sometimes the ground of doing less is very fertile for things to come up, for things to rest and recover and become whole again. And I really believe in that. And I really try to practice that for myself. I had a friend once and I said, I just feel like I'm not doing enough. Why do I feel like I'm not doing enough? And she said, it's because the world around you is moving so fast and you're hitting that all the time. And so I like to have that just as a place to return to, that it's okay to come here and stop and resettle and do the calming, quiet things that really nurture my nervous system and my life in order to do more of those things I love. I won't have the resource, you know, classic, but you can't pour from an empty cup. And I really try to manifest that in my life where I can.
I'm like checking in with myself about this in this moment. Mm-hmm. Just wondering, like, how does that feel to do less? And I'm realizing that it seems that there's like multiple parts of myself that have differing opinions.
100%.
You know? Yeah, like one part is somewhat scared maybe of this this label of being lazy, perhaps, mm-hmm. or being unaccomplished. Somehow it seems connected with how others might view me. And being scared of that. It's like, no, I can't do less. Am I just, you know, copping out? And then there's this other part that's just saying, like, yes, it is this simple, and like trust in this. Like, what's maybe difficult about it is I can't experience the reward now from like letting go into that place. But can I really trust in the outcome? Yeah.
I would say yes, I hear all of those voices too. And I would say one of the things that is good to ground into is to allow yourself to feel the pleasure of things when you are doing less. And not just think of it as a thing to check off. I did this, but what did it feel like when you were doing that? What was there pleasure? Was there sensations that were pleasurable, or did you feel yourself relax? What did you grow from that experience? Because it doesn't just have to be like a mental exercise. It can be a practice. I refer to it as grounding into that positive experience, or you might've heard of the term glimmers, like when something's positive, allowing yourself to really can really trigger a feeling of positivity. And I think it can be important when you are in those moments to just really allow yourself to feel it and embrace it. And it's okay if it goes. It doesn't have to be all the time, but to really allow yourself when it's happening to connect to it.
I think this is so big. My feeling is that it's very widespread that people struggle with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I do myself for sure, but I wonder if we're having trouble like celebrating and enjoying the experiences, there doesn't seem to be many people who want to kind of like fess up to that or on the individual level, because that would be so confusing. Like you're telling me like I made all these plans to go on this vacation and do all these fun things and I'm looking forward to it. And then when I'm actually there, I can't do it. Actually, it's reminding me, there's this little kid, this kids show. You might not, I don't know if you have kids or not, but it's called Bluey. And it's kind of,
I don't have kids, but I know the legend of Bluey.
You know the legend of Bluey. So there's this episode of Bluey and the family is going on vacation and they're just arriving like at the hotel. And the mom keeps talking about she can't wait to get on the beach and relax with her book. Like that's her thing. And they've got to do all the things, check into the place and get set up in the hotel. And she's just, I can't wait to get and just, I just want to relax and do nothing. Just sit on the beach with my book. And they get into the room and then the kids are playing and she can't get everyone to go. And the dad's like, honey, like, why don't you go? It's like, I got it. I got the kids now. Like, go to the beach. She's like, oh, okay, I'll go. And so she goes down there by herself. And then she's like, she's got it. You know, she's the only one on the beach. She's there in her comfortable chair. She's with her book. And she's like, what do I do now? Like,
she can't do it. She can't do it.
The experience. She can't do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it makes me think very profoundly, and why we need to feel these things and practice these things. I had a client many, many years ago said, so what's the point of meditation? Like, why do you do it? And I said, well, I can give you a laundry list of why meditation's good for you. All the benefits, the health benefits. I said, the reason you practice meditation is you won't have access to it as a skill when you need it, if you don't practice it. It's not a thing that you can snap your fingers and command to show up and arrive for you because now you've created space for it. It's an embodied feeling. And, you know, a lot of what we kind of, so by not practicing, allowing spaces to really feel what good feels like, and there's a real reason we lose access to those feelings. You won't have access. So if you want to relax suddenly, well, you can't because your nervous system is living here. So if you never practice, just practice being here. You don't have to be there all the time, but practice all of it. And that's kind of what a healthy nervous system is. A healthy nervous system should have rises and falls to it. But if you only are here or you're only here, you'll struggle to really access it in kind of a fluid way.
I wonder about kind of this the feeling of content.
Mm-hmm.
If it can be practiced, like
absolutely,
just feeling content.
Yeah, I think contentment. I love when I learned the word santosha. Like I was like, oh, contentment. That sounds really nice. And I've had lots of talks with people. I have a lot of people who think contentment isn't enough. Like it sounds too, they're like, well, I'm content with that. And they see it negatively. To me, when I think of contentment, I think of such a subtle warmth, you know, a subtle warmth of a really good spoonful of a really warming stew. And contentment also has boundaries of enough. Contentment is enough, which is nice. And so, yeah, I think contentment is a beautiful thing to kind of ground into.
For some reason, I link this to maturity, like within myself. It's like this kind of challenge that that contentment feels mature, and it's also related to gratitude. Mm-hmm. You know, what I have right now, I don't need anything else. I am, you know, feeling blessed for what this moment is. But then there's this, I don't even know to call it a childlike part of me, or maybe an insecure part of me, or less mature, that is just, again, always just wanting more. Like, you know, the soup isn't good enough. It just needs a little bit of salt, or I need to be reading a book while I'm eating, or whatever it is, just more, more, more. And that's never going to end.
Right. And what I'd also say is that a lot of your responses in situations like this were created before present Avi. Present Avi can very like rationally look at his life and say, I have this, I have that, I'm so grateful for this. But a lot of our responses to things come from that little person who was developed under different circumstances. And that person might not have had access to knowing what enough was. Or that person might not have experienced that feeling. There is such an embodied feeling where you really feel it on all levels, so that then you can respond from that place and feel that space. It's not you present Avi who has to be answered. It's possibly that small Avi who's saying, that's not enough for me. And that's the person to talk to and say, what do you need? Why is this not enough for you now? And that can take you very interesting places. I feel.
Yeah. I wonder what places those could take me. And I wonder why that kind of insatiable thirst was developed, like that habit developed to begin with. Like,
yeah. And everyone's different. Everyone has such a different, it's why personally, like say in trauma work, it can be great to develop a practice. Like you're talking about a practice of gratitude, a practice of meditation, but often if someone's nervous system was informed under trauma, a mental exercise can't get them out of that space because their nervous system has been shaped and educated under these different circumstances. And you might have to do more or different things to shift or change that feeling.
Yeah. So I think this probably connects perfectly. You have an upcoming program here at Yogaville, and it's trauma-informed yoga, right? So mm-hmm. You have seen that there's more, there's a connection here that can happen. So what is this about, and what are you hoping to accomplish for people in the program?
So I truly think of it as an introduction to trauma-informed yoga. We're interacting with people's trauma all day long, whether we call it that or not. Our nervous systems are shaped by our life experiences, and we are meeting people with their life experiences every day, whether we know it or not. I consider trauma-informed yoga to be just another shade of adaptive yoga. We want to make yoga as accessible and friendly for all people if we can. And so I really, so my personal passion in teaching trauma-informed yoga, and I hope also eventually trauma-informed massage therapy one day, is there is some basic biology and understanding of how the nervous system works and is shaped that I really love to share with people. I think yoga teachers, massage therapists, people who are in caring professions often already bring so much kindness and warmth and an ability to hold space for people in their life experiences. And what I like to give them is those bits of extra information that might all of a sudden open a door or a window for them or their client or their patient that they're working with. And for me, the things I'm especially passionate about are kind of what I consider like the biology of trauma and then how your personal presence shows up in trauma work and how you can build that, what you need to be aware of, because there are certain things that are really helpful in trauma work and there can be things that are very unhelpful in trauma work. So it also like anyone taking this program, I just like them to walk away feeling like a little more confident, a little more informed, so that if this shows up in their practice, they feel a little bit more confident about meeting it.
Yeah. Can we dive in a little bit? Like maybe one or two key things that you think if people were informed about, they would make a really big difference for them?
Yes, I think... So I'll say them both so I don't forget. So if you have to help me circle back to it, you can.
Time is good.
One is some stuff about kind of triggers and the biology of trauma and how that works. And then also about what we can offer in terms of our presence for people. So in general with biology of trauma, and what I like people to really understand is that trauma is not necessarily something that someone is, I don't know if in charge is the right word, but trauma happens below, and a trauma response happens below cognitive awareness. It is not a thought out process. Trauma is a biological response to sensations or situations that often immediately causes a reaction. And that's unique to every person what that is. It's not the same for each person, but the process is, and the forming of that trigger is, an event has occurred or events over time have occurred that have caused your survival response to have an immediate response to things. And I find this especially powerful, particularly in the yoga context, because one of the things I think we're so powerfully offering people in yoga and can offer them is the ability for people to begin to offer like a safe space of containment, ability to sit, an ability to maybe begin to interact with their body in a way that maybe a body that may not have felt safe, that now maybe you can start to see ways to begin to feel safe in that body and supported. So there's that.
So interesting. This first point around that, you know, these responses are often happening beyond the cognitive, you know, and they're so deep. And then maybe what I hear you saying is that the potential is to create spaces for people to explore that and maybe get in touch with the actual, I don't know if you'd call them feeling or whatever the response is that comes up, and then to, you know, be aware of it in the body. And then that awareness then is the first step towards healing.
I would say even just at the most basic, even before you say deal with content, yoga just might provide a safe space, particularly if we make some adjustments to yoga. And that's where kind of being a little bit more trauma informed can also help to understand that in these populations, asking perhaps them to just do this and it will work for them might not be the case.
Well, actually, I wonder about this, of just, can there be a potentially trauma associated with just having people tell you what to do with your body?
100%. Bing, 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 bing. It's definitely a big thing in trauma-informed yoga that you want to be aware of is how you speak to clients and students, how you speak to them about their body, using invitational language so that people know that it's not a command. There's no right way to do it. You know, making sure maybe you remove words that might have connotations for people, like, or even like, this is how it should look, you know, commands that make it only be one way. Because a lot of people have come from backgrounds where they didn't have a choice and they couldn't be agents in their own life and experience.
I'm just considering, like, teaching really is so hard. And I think why it's very challenging is because everyone is in a different place. And I've been exploring this for a while and asking people about it. I mean, personally, as a teacher, because of what we're talking about, I use a lot of invitative language, you know, because I think ownership is essential. It has been essential for me. I mean, I probably have some trauma, like, you know, just being a kid in the classroom and just the experience of being a child that so many of us have is you don't have choice. Like, this is what you have to do and there's no choice. And there's a limit to that. And there's a limit that I want to expand out of from that. Right. And in order to do that, I need space to explore what I actually want to be doing. That's the beginning of every class I teach. I always say, this is your time. This is your class. Like, you do what you want with it. However, on the flip side of it, which I totally understand, some people really like to be told, like, don't give me the flowery language, invite me to do it. I just want to know, put my left foot here, you know, give me the bare bones instruction because I just want to follow along. And I get that too. What do you think of this?
I can absolutely see it because I've felt the power of a class where I just let myself surrender to the teacher telling me what to do. And I get to be very mindful and present. And I would say, I understand that when you're adapting to a whole classroom of students, that's always a challenge. So some of what I might be sharing might be more beneficial if you know you're working with a trauma population. But I also don't think that they have to be mutually exclusive. I've had such wonderful, I got to speak to so many teachers coming to the ashram and experiencing from people. And so it's not just about the words you use. You know, I think you can be invitational in how you introduce the class and then teach the class with very clear, direct options. And I think it's also about, so if someone comes to you after class and says, that didn't work for me, I personally would always err on the side of making sure I've added invitation at the start and throughout. But I think you can adjust based on the population you're working with. And I also think part of dealing with people's responses to things is saying, that's good to know. And, you know, maybe letting them have their reactions.
Yeah. I've got this, you remind me of, I've got a t-shirt up in my wall in my kitchen and it says, not everyone's going to like you. You're not an avocado. Not everyone likes avocado either.
No, it's fair.
I think there's a practice in that, you know, and just knowing, okay, like for whatever reason, your energy, your style is not going to be for everyone. And is that okay?
And you can't be responsible for everyone's reaction, but you can bring a little awareness and a little shift in language to how you do things. And you can also kind of maybe recognize the population you're working with that might need more or less adaptation.
So the second thing you mentioned, I think, was presence.
So something I've learned in my massage therapy work, I've been a massage therapist for almost 19 years now. And that practice is what led me to an interest in trauma work, because I started kind of gathering a lot of clients where that was showing up. And I could see where these overlaps were. And what I've just learned in my experience over the years is how much your, not so much what you do, but how you do it and how you show up is the ground for the healing. Just like you're saying, like, if I say the wrong word, it's the power to me is in being present with someone. That's what does the work more than any technique or any advice you might offer. Because by being present with someone else and providing them someone who sees them, who is tending to them in whatever way, you know, your circumstances are calling for, they get to be present with themselves in a way that they might not be allowed in their life. They may have never experienced, and they may not know how to do. And so that you get to offer that to them, which I think is so powerful.
I'm wondering, is there an overlap between being present and being genuine?
I think so. I think that's probably would require a lot of nuance to tell where someone's standing. Because often people think they're being genuine and honest. I would say present. So the term I use, which I heard first from Bonnie Badenoch, is non-judgmental agendaless presence. And I try to use that as my ruler for working with someone and how I am present with them. And those just work really well for me. Cause it's just so broad and they hold so much space.
Just wondering, like, is there a direct correlation between the work, and maybe even work isn't the best word for it. But where I am personally in terms of my relationship with myself, mm-hmm. and the amount of service effect I can have on others, right? Like, is it what we're talking about here? Like, is it possible to fake this? You know?
I'm sure it's possible to fake it, for sure. What I also think is it's probably possible to be trying your best, and that's okay too.
What else can we do?
What else can you do? You know, I particularly like to diffuse that part of anyone's self-improvement, betterment journey that, like, there is a best that you should be reaching. I am personally, like, that does not ring true for me. And I also think the idea that there is a best or even a perfect comes from not great places. This idea that, we are going to get there. It centers some things that aren't great. So I like to just take that out entirely. I think non-judgmental agendaless presence is a great thing to apply to. I mean, that's literally when you're deciding that I'm doing my best is trying to say I don't have an agenda, but it also gives you a chance to investigate. What's the agenda here? And just to know a little bit more about yourself. It's not bad to have an agenda necessarily, but it can be good to start there to kind of look at things.
I notice that it flickers sometimes so quickly, like no agenda, agenda, no agenda, yeah. agenda, you know, yeah. moment to moment.
Yeah. I think that's being human. I think, you know, when you do a lot of trauma work, you talk a lot about the nervous system and how it flows, and a system isn't supposed to be a static line. That's not a healthy system that just does this, no matter what level it's at. A system's supposed to go up and down. And I think that's, again, that's being human. Sometimes I'm here, sometimes I'm there. One is not better than the other. It's just, how are you able to navigate those spaces?
Yeah. And is the answer there for you? Acceptance?
Yeah. Enough. Again, contentment. Enough. And if you're not content, well, what does that mean? And that's the further exploring. And that's the, you know, do you need help from other professionals to explore those topics? Or do you just need more time to investigate with yourself? But it can be a good place to start.
Do you find that there are certain spaces that are harder for you to accept?
Well, sure. There's so many that come flooding in. It's you know, I'd say just from like a personal level, like I prefer quiet spaces to loud spaces. I'm an introvert. I prefer less people to more people. So there's just basic stuff like that. Like me as a human, Rachel, what does she find enjoyable and not enjoyable? And then there are spaces that I find, you know, on like a personal basis, my partner is female. So places where I feel like that's not supported can feel intolerant and aggravating and make me very angry and frustrated. So yeah, there's large levels and small levels.
So if you're finding yourself in a state of anger or frustration, is there an inner dialogue that happens there that can be helpful for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I try to judge the situation I'm in on if I have access. So let's start with, do I have access to cognitive thought or am I just so mad? If I'm just so mad, sometimes that's the best response, is I have to step away. I am not in charge. I'm not in charge of me right now. Whatever I'm feeling is in charge. And that's okay.
You still made the choice to step away.
Yeah, that's for me. That's like the beginning choice, is can I show up and be online and have access to myself in the situation? And then I ask questions like, what is necessary or helpful in this situation? Sometimes anger is an appropriate response to things. And then I might decide, and then what is the action I want from this feeling? So I think for me,
when you say necessary or helpful, do you mean for yourself or for others?
Anger is, we try to contain anger a lot. We try to contain negativity a lot, mostly because of then the action that comes from that. And although other people don't like feeling that, but anger can be a completely rational response to an unjust or unfair situation. A lot of times when I work with people who have trauma, they went through experiences where there was no time, space, or recognition. They were completely overwhelmed. Their boundaries were violated. And they were in a situation where it was rightful to feel angry about this situation. And either the situation didn't allow it was so fast that there was no chance to have like feelings. And that's a lot of how trauma forms and perpetuates, because you have an experience that is so fast, it happens before cognitive skills can kind of come in and say, allow you to express yourself. And sometimes the situation never allowed for that, but the feeling is still there. So it can be really important to begin to develop that process and being able to, because there's not a moral value to something that you are experiencing in your body as a feeling. Like a feeling, it's sensation. A feeling is sensation. There's all the stuff that we put with the feeling, but the feeling is sensation. And you can really, and it's work, and it can be work, particularly depending on the space you have to be able to engage in that and to be allowed to have space to work on that kind of thing. It can be really important to begin to build space to be able to touch into those feelings.
and that's what you're interested in, maybe?
Yeah. So somatic experiencing that I'm training in was created by Peter Levin. If people are interested in learning more about them, traumahealing.org is their website. But one of the things we do in somatic experiencing is help to begin to build space for someone around those sensations and feelings, because a lot of time in trauma at that time or over time, you could not have access to those experiences. It's part of how our survival system protects us. We're creatures who are made to survive. And so we have these defense mechanisms in that say, this feels dangerous. We got to get out of here, or we got to fight this off, or I'm going to shut down completely so I don't have to feel this. And for people who have trauma, someone used a great analogy in one of my last, one of my last colleagues shared this. She said, it's like, you know, we all have survival responses, but for people who have trauma, it's like their smoke detector's right over their toaster. They don't have the space to stop and say. And so a lot of that is skills building then. So a lot of that is okay, well, first let's just start with, we got to build a safe space to sit in. And what are you feeling? And that can be really overwhelming. And okay, let's sit and deal with what comes up with these feelings. And then there's so much further work beyond that that you can do, but that's just kind of the beginning.
Do you think it's possible not to feel, like not to have any sensation at all?
You can work really hard at that. And I would call that dissociation.
But even in meditation, I've heard some people describe it, that this is what's happening, you know, entering that, that even we're talking about contentment before, Santosha, yeah. Right? Yep. Like, is there feeling, is there sensation in that?
Yes. I think, you know, that's where there's like a fine line between detachment and dissociation. And I think what makes them the difference is the ability to put that tool up or down. Meaning like I am in this space and I am in meditation and I am not feeling anything. And I think you absolutely can have that in that moment. And does that stay with you outside of that moment? And should it stay with you outside of that moment?
Yeah. See, I don't think it's possible not to feel. That's my experience. Yeah.
I lean more towards that side of things.
I think we are like feeling machines. That's what we're doing. I think these are certain types of feeling, you know, and it's hard to describe what they are or label them with words, but I don't personally ever, I don't think that.
I think you can disconnect or detach for a time period. Or I also think you can turn your nervous system down to zero. And a lot of people think turning their nervous system down to zero is a good thing and not having any access to sensation. And that I definitely don't agree with. Your nervous system should be in the middle.
Nervous system down to zero. What do you mean by that?
So if you think about, so we'll just use arbitrarily 0 to 100. A system that's hyper-aroused, a system that is very upregulated, might feel like it's always at 100. You know, so that's someone whose heart's racing all the time. Someone who is nervous often, might be irritable, aggressive, because their nervous system is constantly upregulated. They're in their sympathetic system. Someone who is at a zero or experiencing kind of hypoarousal, a downregulated system, might not feel anything, might be completely dissociated from sensation, from feeling. And for, in terms of nervous system regulation, you'd like to maybe be at a 40 to 60. And none of these are absolutes. This is like for the purpose of demonstration, because sometimes you also go high and then go low, and that's part of nervous system recovery. But I like the word access. It's nice to have access to all parts of it and not be, say, stuck up or stuck down.
Yeah, I wonder how the sticking happens, and if this is connected to the stories we tell ourselves, like on the cognitive level.
That definitely encourages it 100%. Also, your biological experiences. You know, if you've been, like, cases of, say, complex PTSD, which are often situations that have happened over longer periods of time, someone's nervous system can be, you know, kind of stuck there or stuck down. At least that's what we see in types of trauma work. And you often have to do some kind of learning to, over time, to allow it. And also, again, it goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning, this idea of like actually feeling what being regulated might feel like. If you've never had access to that in your life, it won't just happen. So whether you begin a gratitude practice and that begins to inform how you feel, or you begin to have positive embodied feeling experiences, for me, yoga was so powerful in my life because it helped me build a safe container to then handle challenging experiences. But for me, yoga was many things, but was largely a place where I could tap into something in a felt sense inside myself. And that was a thing that then I grew in my yoga practice that was so powerful for me.
Why was yoga that for you?
So in my personal life, I had some challenges that existed over many years that couldn't be changed. It's great if you can leave a challenging situation behind, but that's not always available to you. And yoga helped continually allow my body, myself, my nervous system, a safe place to go back to and fill my cup up.
Right. But why did it do it? What about it allowed for that to happen?
It's a good question. I think for me, and massage did this for me as well, allowing me to feel good in my body. And that being able to feel good in my body, it's, you need those reminders. You know, we have a negativity bias in our brain. Again, part of our survival mechanism. Our brain is like, I've got to remember that bad thing because I don't want that bad thing to happen again. But the same structure that allows for that can also help you, can be a resource if you allow yourself to, and you have, if you're allowed to have access to that kind of space.
How is that a resource?
Because if I have only experienced, say, agitation, elevation, anguish, and I also have it, yoga is also a continual practice of some days are good, some days are bad. Some days this feel good, but I learned that what I could do, and that I could go towards that space, and that space was there.
Yeah, the negativity bias is so interesting and important, I think. I wonder, like, when trauma is even first experienced, like, what happens there in those moments? Is a decision made to, I'm going, like, the last thing I want is for this to happen again. And therefore I'm committing to something, like, right, like closing off my heart because my heart is broken and was open. So yeah. I'm committed then. And then that changes everything, that commitment.
So I would say the story comes after the survival response. Somatic experiencing, Peter Levin based his work in part on watching how animals experience trauma. Hmm. And that animals seem to be able to experiencing something that called in the survival response, you know, freeze, fight, flight, and then are able to regulate after that experiences. And so that's what he looked at as he was informing somatic experiencing. But the story comes afterwards, and we humans are really good at the story. That's what we have as humans. And the story, true, untrue, it doesn't matter, but the story perpetuates our response in our body. And that's very cognitive.
I wonder if animals do that on some level too, or what's happening for them, right? Because you have a dog that's maybe been abused, and now for maybe the course of a lifetime, or for a long, if they have a new owner that's not abusive, right? That's still, they're still so afraid anytime they yep. meet someone, or maybe someone that has a profile similar to the person that abused them.
Yes. And I think it's clear and direct in that case. And we as humans have a lot of other adaptive mechanisms we brought online to keep us going through trauma. We're not allowed to bite people if they've been mean to us. We're not allowed to, you know, we're told so many things that would, that we were not allowed to do. Don't express that. Don't talk about that. And all of those things as humans that then can compound to perpetuate that trauma to keep continuing. Gabor Mate, who works in the trauma, you may have, you know, heard some of his talks. He talks about how trauma is not the event. Trauma is the wound afterwards. That's the trauma is the thing that persists. And trauma can persist because of a thing, it's a thing on a physical level that hasn't healed. And trauma can exist because it's not healing in other ways.
Would you generalize and say that, maybe more on a collective level, that what's often happening is a movement from the body to the mind as a way of life? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know about you, but like for me, I can, there's a very different experience that I could have. I realize I can be just operating up in my mind. And then I can, I kind of see it as like a gateway, like the mind can be used as a gateway. Like my, it can say like, you know, connect with the body or feel the whole body. And as soon as I do that, like embody your body, Avi, like that's a message I'll say to myself a lot. And that is a different experience when I'm doing that. I feel like I'm being my like entire self as opposed to just a fraction of myself.
Yep. Yes, I do think, I mean, I had this conversation once. I'm sure if we moved to a paradigm that was 100% giving bodily supremacy, that would also have some negativities. But we live in a world that places much more emphasis on the mind, so much emphasis on the mind. And we learn mental skills, but we don't spend as much time learning how to check in with the body, how to experience the body in a safe and contained way. You know, like when you have children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We teach children like very valuable skills, but there's something so honest about a toddler's feelings. That is honesty on a very true level.
Doesn't get
they are honest. Just feeling it. They are just feeling it. And then we begin to use our mind to contain that as we move through life, to understand and contain. And some of that's very valid. It lets us do, I can't imagine a life where I, you know, melted down every day over things, you know, that's important learning. And it can be important to not lose that skill entirely of, I feel a thing in my whole body right now. Mm. Because that has such an honesty to it. I call it, in somatic work, we were talking once about, I brought to the idea of the unreliable narrator. Why maybe we check in with the body over the mind? And, you know, unreliable narrator is a term used in fiction when your narrator, you trust everything they say. And that's how they use that to kind of all of a sudden at the end, oh, look, this thing happened, because you automatically trust the narrator. And there are reasons for sometimes in trauma work to check into the body, because if the body is feeling something, it is feeling something. It doesn't matter the shades of, am I right to feel that? Am I wrong to feel that? Is it in my head? You're still experiencing that feeling. And it's just such a really powerful tool to have at your disposal. It doesn't mean you don't use both, but it's nice to have access to both.
This is something you feel like personally you've made progress in regards to?
I think so. I think in certain areas for sure, in certain areas not at all. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an ongoing practice. You know, I have jobs where being calm with another person is something I do regularly, so that might help.
In order to be calm?
Just to that ability to be like, we're just going to hold presence together, and I'm going to feel like massage is a space where it's good to be aware of, you know, what's happening in my body as I work. So, but also have the mind online, and taking, so it's just good to practice in those spaces of having access to multiple things at once.
Right. Yeah. I imagine so. What do you do in order to accomplish that? Like, you believe that you know, being in your body will allow you to serve better, right? So how can you do that?
I mean, for me, it's all of the, it's what I call sometimes all the things. Time for yoga when I am in my body. Time for meditation when I am watching thoughts come up and giving myself the space to take them in or not, to investigate those thoughts. It's allowing myself the time to slow down for the body. Minds move very fast. I think in general, bodies move slower, or there's a language barrier sometimes between the mind and body that needs to allow for translation.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a sort of mantra, even that's happening.
Yep.
That's helpful in order to stay present. Like, do you have a certain mantra that you would say that you use that helps you to stay present? Maybe just be present. I don't know.
I would say I spend a lot of time in dialogue with my mind of, is that true? Mm. Which works well for me as someone who has experienced anxiety for most of her life since she was a child. And so it's very powerful for me to, is that true? And ask both the body and the mind. I.e., if my heart is racing, is that true?
Is it true that the heart is racing, or like you notice
it is, but where is that coming from? You know, what is that true? Is that reliable? Am I getting reliable data?
It's powerful stuff.
Yeah. I love it. I also like working in this field. I think people feel heavy when they hear the word trauma. And trauma is really entering, I think, kind of like the zeitgeist and popular treatment and popularity out there of I've had trauma. And I know that that can be really like, for some people, take that on and it becomes kind of negative and limiting. But for me, trauma is, yes, a sign that we can be changed, but also a sign that our bodies can change. And there's kind of other sides of the coins for me, which is that, you know, I often talk with people about yoga as a neuroplastic exercise. Yoga is a practice through which our brain and our nervous system actually changes through doing it. And I love that side of the coin, that there is possibility. Trauma education has made me feel really proud of what my body could do for me when I didn't have the mind space and the mind available to digest or understand a situation. And I hope maybe even some people who, if they come and participate in this weekend, take that away, that sense of, there are things that can be done and things that are helpful and things that are useful.
Yeah. One thing I think that's so useful is being in community around doing this, right?
Yeah.
And that's absolutely what potentially is created. And maybe originally too, is maybe one of the factors that you were experiencing, you know, with
100%.
Yeah.
Before I knew what co-regulation was, which is part of polyvagal theory, which is just basically the idea in a small nutshell, is that our systems regulate off of other people's systems. If someone projecting calm often calms your nervous system, someone being worked up often works up your nervous system. So yes, absolutely. Those things are happening. And I love that overlap so much.
One thing you mentioned earlier, I really appreciate, is maybe just dispelling this idea that there's an end or there's a top of the mountain to get to, which I think is, you know, very common. And I also have, that doesn't resonate for me in my experience. That to me, what's more real is just progression, growth, healing, if we use the word healing, you know, which never ends. And I'm okay with that. I don't need it. I don't need for there to be an end. However, I think it is important for the mind to be clear on what the goal is. So yeah. Is the goal to get to an end place to be completely healed, or is the goal simply to make progress?
Yeah. And the goal is what each person defines it as. For me, I think of is this working for me or not? And just, no, I'm agitated all the time, so maybe it's not working for me. Or yes, I feel at peace about this. It's working for me. And I think the picture needs to be shaped by you and what you want your picture to look like. I believe you do some coaching too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, coaching is the effective coaching comes out of figuring out what that person wants it to look like, not what you want it to look like or what a prescribed definition of what it's supposed to look like.
Yes. Yes. But there seems to be a play here between what I want to look like and what is possible.
Yeah.
Right. Like I could want it to look like that there's an end and I'm completely healed or I'm enlightened. Like I've reached the mountaintop. That's it. It's over. Like I could like that, you know, yep. But that doesn't change the reality of whether or not that's actually possible.
Right. Yes, and I'm personally never too invested in is it possible? But that's me personally. Meaning like that's not a I think some people are really motivated on by like what's next? What else can I do? And I think that's fantastic. It's just not my personal motivation.
What's your personal motivation?
I would say my personal motivation is what do I need to show up for my life in the most present way that I can, in the most joyful way that I can. And for me, my personal guidance is taking care of myself as well as I take care of other people. So continually going back to, my own check-ins.
This is a topic. You've kind of brought up a topic that's of great interest to me because I find that there's such a connection here that it's hard to even separate taking care of myself and taking care of other people.
Yep.
You know, because my ability to take care of other people is a direct byproduct of my ability to take care of myself. And also, I find that taking care of other people is also a way of taking care of myself. It's yes. Some need that I have, right? Like Swami Satchidananda says, who will be the happiest person? The one who brings happiness to others.
Yep.
And I believe that that's true.
Yeah, 100%. I think that requires honesty too of, am I resourcing myself to do that? It's not a direct line path. Like I will get there. It's a constant check-in. Today I'm not able to show up for someone else or the person I will show up as I am presently might be harmful or hurtful. And just being, including yourself and the people who get taken care of.
Yeah.
And also I really believe that I have learned better how to care for other people by taking care of myself. But again, it's an oft-used word, but I need to embody and know what being taken care for feels like.
Yeah. It's cool. You know, I think that it should be number one, because if I zoom out and see what does the world look like with every human being seeing it as their primary responsibility to care for themselves, what does that world look like? You know, and it's very practical.
Yeah.
Because I don't control anyone else the way that I control me. There's this relationship with myself that actually I think leads to a lot more satisfaction, because so much suffering happens trying to control things outside of me.
Yeah. And it's, I think, much more scary to work on yourself, much more terrifying to work on yourself, but perhaps much more fruitful because like you said, it's also a faster path towards change. You will have much more success changing yourself than someone else. Yeah.
And why is it scary? To me, this is also a really interesting question. The answer that comes up for myself is like all around identity.
Yeah.
Like that's why it's scary, because I've established this identity, this conversation again on a cognitive level of how I define myself.
Yeah.
And therefore I can be disturbing that.
Yes. And disturbing that could come with a lot of overwhelming feelings and sensations. And it will. A lot of the identity that we built, the habits that we built, are to deal with a feeling we don't want to feel.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Rachel, thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This was great. I enjoyed myself.
Awesome. Thanks for all the work that you do.
Thanks, Javi.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this content and think others might as well, please feel free to share and subscribe.